welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, welcoming you to the choices and knowledge of those choices that'll help make your dreams come true. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. We archive at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. We also link to our guest's website. We'll be giving you our guest's linked website here shortly, where you can check out more of the information that is available. And I think that you're going to enjoy this program, especially if you're an animal lover. I grew up with the traditional urban. I think my sister, she had a parakeet or two or three. We had hamsters and gerbils. Well, yeah, mostly gerbils. We had a dog for a couple of days because he was roaming the streets, and we caught him and called the Humane Society. We had a cat, a calico cat, named Calico, and she was also an animal who came upon us. My parents did not, or at least my father did not, want to have animals. I don't know the full extent of that. I've never really gone there with him on that, but nonetheless, we didn't grow up with a lot of animals beyond what I've described. Now I live in Santa Barbara, above Santa Barbara, in a rural area where we have dogs. We have two dogs, two shepherds, a male and a female, black and white, black and a white one. We have six kittens, lost our pride and joy back on April 15th of this 2016. And so we have six kittens. We had chickens, lost them in a sad massacre one December night. But we have also had deer and bear and bobcats and little rodents and prairie dogs, if you will, or quail, and the list goes on of the different things that you can see. But the biggest question of all to all of us is, are we aware of what they are trying to tell us by their appearance? And this has always fascinated me. And maybe we'll get into a little bit of the totem aspect. And we're going to talk about that with Amelia Kincaid, the author of Whispers from the Wild, Listening to the Voices from the Animal Kingdom. And Amelia, thank you so much. This is fantastic for you joining us here on the program today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Richard. And from that lineup of critters, you made me want to jump in the car and drive up there.
Well,
I'm in Los Angeles now, and I've just gotten back from a 10-month world tour. I've been living out of one suitcase for 10 months.
Oh, geez.
And this book is about primarily my relationship and communications with animals in Africa. So the first chapter is about tigers, and I'm very, very concerned about tiger conservation. The second chapter is lions, and most of them I met in Africa, but I also meet tigers and lions all over the world. Elephants in Thailand, but the ones that I'm writing about here are in Africa. And I'm leading safaris where people can actually go meet this exact same elephant family, the family that I have the most connection with. That, let me tell you, Richard, this is how intelligent they are. They will be waiting at my tent when I land. Now, the last time I landed, and my guide came and picked me up at the airport, and he said to me, "Lady, we knew you were coming. We knew you were coming to the camp." I said, "How did you know?" He said, "The elephants are waiting at your tent." Now, they know before my plane lands that I'm coming, and they know which tent I'm in.
Wow.
Now, if I move from one camp to another, and I say to this family, "Listen, I've got to go. I'm leaving tonight. I'm going to this other camp, which is miles away. Will you meet me there in the morning?" This family of five elephants will show up 5:30 in the morning outside my chalet, no matter where I go. So one of the things I'm talking about in this book is trying to tap into how outrageously intelligent other animals are. And I do say other animals because people always say to me, "Oh, do you work with humans or only animals?" And I say, "You mean other animals."
Well,
other animals.
Yeah, I have to tell you that every one of us who has domesticated animals has to have experienced at least once, if not more than 100 times, that similar experience when returning home from a journey or work or even a trip to the store and back, where one of their animals will be sitting and waiting in exactly the same spot every single time.
Right.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that they heard the car drive up, because what if you don't have a car?
No.
And on and on. I mean, we have this quite regularly. Our late Maine Coon cat, Merlin, used to sit on the counter, the sink counter, just inside the front door as we would come in the kitchen, and he'd be sitting there waiting. And, of course, my wife is always asking the same question when we come. You think he's been there all day? And I said, no, he's not been there all day. But she has been home, and I've been away, and she says, do you know that like 5 minutes before you drove up, he jumped up on the counter?
That's right.
Now, this implies, and I don't know if there's scientific evidence, maybe you have access to that information.
There is.
That the animal kingdom is telepathic.
That's right. Now, if you can imagine, and the entire thing that you're talking about there was documented by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. One of the biggest honors of my life was having Dr. Sheldrake in the front row.
Oh,
when
nice.
I taught a workshop at the Field Conference in London many years ago, they flew in all of these quantum physicists from all over the world. I mean, Fritz Albert Popp was there. And then they fly me in, the doggy psychic from Los Angeles, not knowing what on earth is going to happen or who's going to, you know, want to come to my little workshop. I had 800 people in the auditorium. Everybody wanted to talk about this. So now I'm going to talk about a different book that I did not write. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake wrote the book, Dogs Who Know When Their Animals Are Coming Home. And they put cameras inside the houses and had people come home at random times. So it wasn't the normal routine. As soon as the person turned around and started heading back home, the dog would run for the door. So what he's proving is that other animals are connected on a stream of thought and energy, that we are all one massive consciousness. We are, the earth is living and alive and breathing. I mean, she is one enormous organism.
Mm-hmm.
And every single animal is a cell on her skin. You know, we're cells in the body of God. And all the other cells within that body can communicate with each other. And that's one of the reasons why nature, aside from the human species, is in perfect harmony. I mean, how can it stay in such perfect harmony at all times? Because there's some sort of interconnection. Now, the new word for that is called the zero-point energy field. The
mm-hmm.
zero-point energy field is the ocean of electromagnetic impulses that house within it every record of every living being. So on a quantum level, everything in the world is connected and dancing. The energy is being expelled from every living thing, and it's being absorbed by other living things. So one of my greatest mentors in this life was an astronaut named Edgar Mitchell. And Dr. Mitchell walked on the moon in the Apollo 14 mission, and was one of the most brilliant rocket scientists, if not the most brilliant, of the last century. So when he got back from the moon, he started the Institute of Noetic Science, which was a study group where quantum physicists and some of the world's greatest minds were studying what was known as paranormal phenomenon or supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Mitchell said there is no paranormal. If one person can do it, it's normal. There is no supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
If it's happening on Earth, it's natural.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those elephants can communicate with each other your dog is communicating with you, and you don't even know it. You've left the house, you've gone on run errands, you're on the grocery, and your dog knows where you are. And to take it much further than that, they know what you're thinking, they know what you're feeling, they know your medical history, they know what's going on inside your body. They're so much more perceptive and intelligent than we are that we tune them out because of a kind of arrogance. When humans decide that they're more intelligent than everybody else, of course they're going to shut down that capacity to hear, because that connection is like a radio, that there's a different way to receive information in your body, and it's coming in your heart. But your heart has to be open, and yours obviously is, Richard. I'm sure you have so many of these experiences where you know your dog's able to read your thoughts.
Well, I have to say that the one way thought, yes, is that is true. I have on more than, and actually just recently on our. We have two shepherds. One is a white shepherd. She's the eldest. She's probably 13 or 14. Her name is Makushla. We got her when she was a year old. She'd been hit by a car, and they decided not to put her down, but to put a pin in her leg and so forth and what have you. Then the other is a male. He's a big king, black king shepherd. His name is Angus. He sleeps up on the bed, believe it or not. He's about 120 pounds. Gives you an indication of what it's like sleeping on the bed at night with a big dog. But there are times when I will get up and he will just raise his head and look at me, like, for example, if I'm tending the fire in the fireplace, and then he'll lay his head back down. And I take that look that he gives me as, you're disturbing me a little bit here, but I appreciate the fact that you're taking care of the fire and keeping us warm. Okay, I'm going back to sleep now. He has, and you can help me on this as well, because animals in general, but dogs specifically, as I have learned over the years, having married into a family, into a relationship with a woman who had a pack of four Siberian huskies, and they were sled dogs. And I have learned that you have to learn why an animal, a dog specifically, why a dog is doing what it's doing. This, you know, someone who owns a dog does not get the dog to behave in a particular way because the human wants the dog to behave in a particular way. If the dog exhibits a particular behavior is really what I'm trying to get at. You have to understand why the dog is doing that. Why is the dog tearing up the sofa? Or why is the dog jumping up and down and so forth? And I've also learned that dogs in particular need a job.
That's right.
Now, it doesn't have to be an extended long-term kind of 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. No. Some people say, that's a job? This is my Angus's job. When we come home in the evening, probably maybe an hour after we get home, he starts jumping around saying, let's go outside because I want to chase the tennis balls. It's time for me to go to work. So I went out and I bought a bucket of 48 tennis balls. Now, he doesn't fetch. That I need to make clear. He does not run, get it, and bring it back. Otherwise, I'd only need one or two. He chases them. Then he runs back to me. He points. Literally, I got him to point.
That's right.
Pick one. Pick one.
And he picked. I was going to cut you off.
Yeah. And then I throw the one he picked.
His job is to make sure you work out. He is your workout coach.
Yeah. And
it has nothing to do with him chasing balls. He's making sure that you exercise, because his job is to take you out and make you chase balls.
Yeah. And so we play this game, and sometimes we'll only play it for 5 or 10 minutes, especially if it's really cold or the weather is really rough. And so we want to make sure he gets a little time outside, okay? And usually he's satisfied. Not always. And sometimes we're out there for half hour, 45 minutes. And it's fun. And I love watching this dog run. I'm sure you have watched horses, whether it's on a track or out in the open, and they're wild. And it's the way that the horses move, the rippling of the muscles, as especially the flanks, as they're racing across the land. It's so beautiful. Well, when this dog runs, it's like watching a horse run. And he's almost as big as a horse. But I want to talk, I want you to talk to me about that aspect of animals in general, and especially the ones that you deal with, and whether they also, even in the wild, need to have a job, even though we may not consider that, even if it's not out there getting prey, getting food for the rest of the pack or whatever it is. Maybe it's doing something else that seems rather innocuous, but to them and to that animal, that's very important. I got to do this every day, and the sun is in the right spot. It's time. Da-da-da-da-da. Do other animals have jobs in that context? Oh.
Gosh, well, absolutely. I mean, with my elephant friends as an example, if one elephant gets sick, the herd will assign a nursemaid. There'll be a doctor. If one of them is elderly, another one will be assigned to walk slowly with that one. My own elephant family that I love so much had a tragedy, and I don't even want to go into this because I don't want to have a negative ending to a beautiful story. I mean, this family still has gone on, but the one that I love the most got killed last year. Her name was Naughty. This is the daughter of Queen Wonky Tusks, who walks through Mufui Lodge. So for your reader or your listeners, anybody who wants to come on a safari in the most magical place in the world, I'm taking people out to meet my lions and my leopard friends and my elephant friends. And they'll be waiting for the truck and showing us their latest leopard cubs and showing us their babies. Well, they'll assign a new mom, so a stepmother takes over to raise a baby if that baby's mother gets poached. So in the wild, the animals all have their own jobs within their herd or their flock or their pack. And what you were saying earlier, I absolutely couldn't agree more. I mean, rather than coming in and saying, don't do that, redirect the energy and say, this is what I do want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than chewing the shoe, this is your chew toy. Rather than tearing up the couch, this is your scratching post. Let's go do something wonderful and fun together. And what your dog is doing, it's giving you a job.
Mm-hmm.
He's making sure that you come home, go outside, clean your energy field, detox yourself from the day, reconnect to nature, get fresh air, get exercise, get some joy and happiness in your body. He has a job. And it's not to chase balls.
Mm-hmm.
He's your workout coach. He's your shrink. He's your doctor. He's your clown. He's your cheer-up committee.
Yeah. Oh, no question. No question.
And when he's sleeping there, he's keeping peace in the household, I guarantee.
Well, now, let me ask you something in that regard. Now, I'm going to go back to the dogs. I'm sure that there is a way to train Angus specifically not to get into a particular place. We have six cats, ergo we have a number of cat boxes. And we both know what dogs like to eat. So I don't want him to do that. And for the longest time, because the cat boxes are exposed, he would be over there nuzzling through and so forth. And of course I'd catch him and I'd put him in his crate. Bad dog. And then all of a sudden I thought, you know, that's not fair to him. He needs to have the freedom to roam the house. So what I did was I didn't have to move the cat boxes because I knew that would freak the cats out. So I put up a barrier, a wall of sorts that he can't get over or in through, with a kitty door that the cats can get to the boxes, but he can't. And now he can roam the kitchen. This is where the boxes are. He can roam the kitchen freely and not get in trouble and not have to get tossed into his crate, as it were. But there's one activity that I still haven't been able to wean him from, so to speak, and that is chasing the cats. Now, in some instances, it's play. I know that the bigger cats, the adult cats, he's chasing them. They're letting him do it because they do have an escape route. We have a door that's propped open and latched. He can't get through the opening, but the cats can. But there is one tiny kitten, a cat actually, it's a small cat, who is very skittish, and actually I'd have to describe her more as feral. I call her Kit Kat. She's a little gray, dark gray kitty. And she's just not real. She's not a happy cat. She will see him from across the room and start hissing and spitting. He's not even in the room, but he's maybe across the threshold in the other room. And she'll start just going berserk, you know, you better not, you know. But he will chase her if she gets down on the floor. And we don't want him to do that. And when you don't want an animal to do something, I heard what you said. Then give the animal something that you want them to do.
Right. And give them the information that you want them to know. Now, okay. In a situation like this, I would go to the dog and I would say, this is your new cat. This kitten is your kitten. I got this kitten for you. So I need you to be gentle. Mm-hmm. Not to scare your cat. You're the protector of this kitty. She's afraid of you. And I'm going to visualize what I do want, which is him being gentle, moving slowly, being careful around the cat. And then I'm going to go to the kitten and do just the opposite and say, listen, you can defend yourself. You may be small, but you are the queen of this household. And if you need to use your claws to defend yourself, that's great.
Mm.
Because I want you to feel powerful and in charge. This, you have a giant troll as your protector. We've got a huge giant troll to protect you.
Right.
But you keep him in line.
Right. So is our telepathic means our imagination, our mind's eye?
Exactly. And see, what you're projecting there, Richard, is that he could hurt her, which means you're projecting the idea that you don't trust him. And you're projecting to her the idea that she's vulnerable and defenseless and that you need to intervene. And a lot of the time when humans intervene, the animals don't get to work out the relationship.
Okay.
I mean, I see this all the time where the new puppy's brought in. It looks like your existing dog is attacking the new puppy, when in fact what they're doing is what they do in the wild and wolf behavior. The elder dog has to teach the new one manners. And the way they do that might be to take that one with its mouth. The big dog would put its mouth over the snout and then roll the other one on its back. And it looks terrible.
You're right.
But what they're doing is they're saying, no, that's not what we do in this house. I'm going to teach you the house rules. And you're allowing them to have their own hierarchy.
Okay.
You're allowing the one to be in charge who's trying to teach the other.
So the advice that I was given about a year or so ago, we took ownership of a beautiful purebred German Shepherd. We named her Bridget, and she was given to us by a gentleman who was in his 80s. He'd gotten the puppy as a sort of replacement after his dog, and then his wife had passed away, so he was looking for companionship. But as she was growing, she was becoming more difficult to care for and take care of. My wife found out about it, and, well, anyway, we ended up taking her home. Well, we also had Angus, who was, I think, between 2 and 3 at the time. Now, we had her for 15 months, and we had trainers come over, and we worked with them, and we worked with Angus, and we worked with Bridget to try to bring them together. And the advice that was given to me by somebody else was, why don't you just put them in the backyard and let them work it out? And our biggest concern was the potential for injury, because both of these dogs were already good size, powerful. And yet, I hear what you're saying. So how does the human mind put that into a concept that they can not only accept, but adjust to. And then, I mean, and what if there are injuries? I mean, that again, because Angus, he handles Makushla because she raised him from a pup when he was 8 weeks. Okay? So she has that relationship. But when we brought Bridget in, no way. And we had two or three different trainers come in to try and bring the two of them together, and it didn't happen.
Well, you're projecting your fear.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing what you don't want. You're seeing them attack each other.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Rather than saying to him, I love you, I trust you, I've brought in a female, she needs your help and protection. Then in a situation where she really needs to rely on you, you as the alpha male, sort it out. I totally agree, and I'll tell you one of the craziest situations where I've ever seen and learned this message was in Florida. I was brought in to work with an epileptic lynx, if you could imagine.
Yeah.
And in this lynx sanctuary, and we did start sorting that out. He had a lot of post-traumatic stress because he'd been left out in the rain. His cage was out in these electrical storms in Florida. But the people had a cat sanctuary for little house cats. Now, I walk into their bedroom, and I see they've got a rubber sheet on the bed, and there are 29 house cats in that room in perfect harmony. Nobody's fighting with anybody, and they never did. And then I look up, and I see at the top of this cat tree, there's this big old greasy black and white mafioso of a cat, this big old one-eyed cat. And he's looking down on his entire tribe. And when I said to the people, what do you do when you introduce a new cat? They said, we open the door, we toss it in, and we shut the door. And that cat sorted everything out because he was the king. So they will, of course they will. God made these creatures. We think we have to interfere with everything they do, and we don't. They know how to get along,
mm-hmm.
and it's our fear that they're going to hurt each other.
Mm.
And if the alpha in the house, now alpha means calm, confident, and in charge.
Ah.
If you're going to go in and say, listen, I'm your father. This is how it works in my house. I bring in a new dog. You two live together in perfect harmony. I brought you someone to fall in love with. You'll play together. You'll eat together. You'll sleep together. You get along perfectly because I'm alpha. You relax. And that's it.
Hmm. You know, that's interesting because it's the same. It's the same exact formula, if you will, when people talk about the secret and the law of attraction. I don't want debt. Guess what you're going to get?
That's it.
And so forth.
Yeah. One of the stories in this book, I'm face to face with a black mamba who was in my kitchen in Africa in a hut in the lion's camp. Now, if I visualized what I didn't want, I wouldn't be on the phone with you right now.
Mm-hmm.
These are, the Africans consider the most dangerous snake in the world. I mean, by the time you're face-to-face, 5 feet away from a black mamba, you're dead. And I had to visualize what I do want. I had to turn the energy around so that I was calm, confident, and in charge. Let me tell you, it's not easy to do. You're face-to-face with an 8-foot snake. That's the most dangerous snake in the world.
Yeah.
But I was forced to go into that heart space where I'm going to look at her and say, you're beautiful, you're vulnerable, the humans are more dangerous than you, I don't want you to be harmed. When you're ready, and I wouldn't open the door, you can leave at your leisure, but I'm just really enjoying getting to meet you and being able to love you and to honor you and to treasure you.
Yeah, that's an interesting example because I have been face-to-face on, well, two occasions, and it was actually the same evening, with a big brown bear up on the property where we live.
Boy, do you know what I'm talking about then.
And it's really funny, too, because I was taking care of the chickens in the coop at the time, and sadly, one of them had passed, so I was dispatching it and taking it up the hill to the appropriate place. And I heard this rustling in these bushes up on this hill, just literally along the roadside. And I looked over, and we were a good 20, 30 feet away, of course. And I looked over there, and I'm like, what is that sound? And I just stopped, just, you know, curious. I'm wondering, what is that sound? And all of a sudden, the bear pokes his head up over the shrubs, and he's eating from a loquat tree. Or maybe it was a plum tree, one of the two. There were two of them there. And I just looked at him, and I thought, okay, he's eating, you know, and I'm not going to bother him, and he won't bother me. So I continued on to my destination. I turned around, and I went back. So I came down the hill, and my wife sees me. She says, what's going on? I said, I just saw a big bear. I want to see the bear. I want to see the bear. So hang on. So I needed to close up the coop and everything, and so we both walked back up the hill. And again, the rustling, and he poked his head up over the shrubs, and neither of these two times did I have any fear, none whatsoever. And he's looking at us, and finally he gets up on on his hind legs, he turns around, and he walks across the dirt road to the paved road, which is called Stagecoach, and heads down Stagecoach Road. Almost as if to say, look, I was eating, you've interrupted my dinner, I'm leaving. And again, that was a situation where, I mean, I wasn't really, my thought processes were not engaged. My experiential and observational senses, if you will, were engaged. How do we put ourselves in that experiential observational mode that you described with the Mamba, In with our domesticated animals, and especially those of us who live on the fringes of wildlife, you know, so that we not only can better coexist with the wildlife, but that we can better coexist and cohabitate, if you will, with our domesticated animals.
I'm so glad you're asking me this, and you've worded this so beautifully. So this is my sixth book, Richard, and what I teach and what I've been teaching all over the world for the last 16 years is how to get into that space. Now, I'm going to move myself into a place inside my body that's actually lower than my brain. So if you have a sense of your lungs and your breath and your heart, and you're operating from your heart, now we're going to move into a consciousness where there is no thought and there is no emotion. So there can't be any fear there because we're moving into the spirit within us that knows only love, that only has this sense of awe. Now, what you had, that sense of awe, that you're looking at one of nature's masterpieces.
Huge masterpiece.
And we can't assume that they're violent or they're going to attack humans. They never do. I mean, I say almost every animal on the planet is just minding his own business, trying to make a living in the world. As we continue to encroach on their territory, they don't come after humans and attack us. Now, if they're threatened, they would. If you had rushed at the bear or poked him with a stick, I guarantee he would have defended himself.
I know better than to poke the bear, okay?
That's right. But being in that state of grace, where you're looking at this animal in a silent, reverent state of being grateful and admiring them and saying, my gosh, you know, we're living on this planet alongside such beauty. Mm. Whether you're working with a butterfly or a cheetah or an elephant or your own domestic dog, your own Maine Coon, your own birds in your backyard, and to simply be in a silent, quiet place. Now, I'm not paying attention to anything else. So this is another part of what you're saying, it, the secret teaches. You are your awareness. And if my awareness is that bear's point of view, now, is it a male or a female? Maybe she's pregnant. Maybe she's looking for a place to have her baby. I want to tune into her and say, who is this being? You know, what are they doing? What's their point of view? And now I'm caring about them to the exclusion of all else. I want to sit with that dog and say, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? What do you need? Now, that takes the focus off me, and it puts me in a state of consciousness where I can listen. So we're just trying to get people to focus back on the beauty of the world around them and go into a silent place inside of themselves where they can learn to listen.
This is extraordinary. I'm glad that we've had the opportunity to have you on the program. We're not done yet. We've got more to come, folks. Stay tuned. I want to give you the website. It is ameliakincaid.com. That's A-M-E-L-I-A-C, a K. Try that one. I'm going to go back again. That's A-M-E-L-I-A-K-I-N-K-A-D-E. That's ameliakincaid.com. The book, again, that we're talking about, but more in general about our fine feathered and furry friends and even slippery friends, is Whispers from the Wild, Listening to the Voices from the Animal Kingdom. We're going to talk more, maybe a little bit more, about the more esoteric and ethereal aspects of our animal friends and the animal kingdom as well as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking with Amelia Kincaid. AmeliaKincaid.com is the website. Whispers from the Wild, Listening to the Voices from the Animal Kingdom. And Amelia, again, I'm blown away by our opportunity here to converse and talk about this particular subject. There's an aspect of this, however, that is unfortunately more difficult to talk about for a lot of us, because we have such a not only do we have such a love for the animal kingdom, but we also want to see the human race, if you will, also survive and prosper and go on to, I don't know how many generations, folks. I really don't. We want that for our species as well. And I know, Amelia, that when I went camping a number of times, actually hiking with some buddies of mine. I had a men's group back in 1993, folks, we would go into the wilderness and we'd hike and so forth and so on. And one of the guys was a professor, and he would talk to us about the ecosystem that we were walking through and the various plants. And then we'd come across certain little critters and this and that and the other. And he would explain how if one of these elements was removed from this ecosystem, it would change it irreparably. So my concern in this little segment is over the changing of the ecosystems that we currently have, shall we say, left, and the fact that, whether you are accepting of the fact that we have some impact on our environment, which I believe we do, and one of the greatest lessons animals can teach us is, and if I may use this vernacular, Amelia, animals do not crap where they eat.
That's right.
Except humans.
That's exactly right.
Talk to me about the... Honestly, I think the right word is the delicate, fragile balance when you have a complete ecosystem and you remove one, what might seemingly be an innocuous element from it.
Well, You're asking me something I could talk about for 20 hours instead of 1 hour, but I'll touch on a couple of different ideas here. Now, when we're talking about the bear minding his own business, in actuality, elephants have the right to kill every human they see. I mean, sharks could kill every single human that gets in their water. After what we've done to their ocean and what we're doing to their environment, and I have an entire chapter on great white sharks. I have an entire chapter on whales and how some of our experiments are interfering with their sonar. So it's a matter of raising awareness. When I'm in Africa, I have a charity called Archangel. This is my new nonprofit. And I go into rural communities and I work with the children, because the children ultimately are going to inherit this planet. And in Rwanda, I work with a gorilla, and I had 180 orphans in a field a year and a half ago, drawing gorilla, dancing as gorilla, making up theater about gorillas and poaching so that these kids don't grow up to be poachers. In Lusaka and in Zambia, I do it with the elephants, and in the Kruger, I do it with the lions. So the children are dancing with lions, drawing lions, talking about lions, knowing that they can get other kinds of jobs protecting the animals so that they don't have to poach the animals. So changing consciousness, and it's already happening. You know, the kids being born these days are just on fire. They don't even, the babies don't even look like babies anymore. I saw one yesterday, and I looked down into a baby carriage. I didn't know it looked like a 40-year-old man just waiting to walk and talk. They're walking and talking sooner. They're evolving so much quicker. We've got this new breed of children coming in that really care about the planet. So one of the things we can do is teach the children. Every chapter that I've written has a different way to help, and I'm going to give you the most upbeat of them. Because I work with tigers who are almost extinct, and I work with lions so that we can try to stop can lion hunting, and I work with the sharks, which are being finned. I mean, these are all dreadful stories. The easiest thing that we can save is perhaps the single most important creature we have on land, and that's our bees. Now, here's a funny idea, really. The idea that humans have decided we have to have these green, trimmed, pesticided lawns of grass in front of our homes, which actually do nothing. I mean, you know, it's not an herb garden. It's not a vegetable garden. It doesn't help us in any way. It doesn't even mean anything. It's completely arbitrary. If people would just plant a little wildflower garden in addition to their lawn, and they don't put any pesticides on this wildflower garden. So what I'm doing this year is putting little packages of wildflower seeds on every single gift I give. And that's what I'm encouraging people to do this holiday season, little packages of wildflower seeds. Now, if every single person would go out and plant a little bit of wildflowers on their side yard even, we could completely restore our bee population on this planet. Now, that's how easy it is to make a difference. You just sometimes have to think a little bit more creatively.
Hmm. Well, I couldn't agree more in that respect, because when we moved to Santa Barbara, and I was born and raised in urban Phoenix, Arizona. There's no rural Phoenix anymore. I didn't have that much contact with wildlife. I mean, you know, insects, yes. Birds, yes. Much bigger than that? No. You didn't have skunks and wolves and coyotes and things like that roaming the flatlands of the concrete jungle, as it were. When I moved here, everybody said, oh my gosh, how wonderful it is, and on and on and on. And I remember discussing this with my mother, who said that it's going to be an adjustment, you know, and it was a little bit of an adjustment. Number one, because it wasn't flat land. And there were times when I was saying, oh, my kingdom for flat land. And because I was either walking uphill or downhill. or over rocks and dirt and gravel and so forth. But we live on a hill. And one of the things that I came to realize, not out of making the mistake, but just thinking it through, was that if, for example, I was going to do an oil change on my vehicle up there, okay? And let's just say I was in two places at once and I lived down the hill from me. Would I let that oil drain out onto the hillside and down the hill? No, because I live down the hill. And I don't know what kind of an impact that's going to have on my water supply, on the groundwater, on the ground itself, on the trees and the plants, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in California, as I know you know, Amelia, you know, with this ongoing drought that we have been experiencing, you know, into 2017, which, you know, hopefully we're going to see some respite from that in time. You know, we've been losing plants, but more because of the drought due to a lot of other, what I'm going to call natural occurrences because of the drought. The drought to me is relatively a natural occurrence. It happens. I remember when Australia was on fire for a summer, and I remember when in Russia they were going through their drought, and we were doing great here in 2006, 7, 8, and so forth. I said, you know what? Our turn is coming. Our turn is coming, and then our turn will pass, and it will pass on to someone else. And it's sort of that cyclical thing. But we tend to not take that seriously, and yet there's so much, as you say, that we can do. Am I correct that, for example, when somebody plants a garden, even like their food garden? Okay, and some people are really getting into that now too. You know, and almost to the extent of having their own farm, with chickens and other animals as well as growing plants and so forth. That there are certain flowers. You were talking about this. My wife is very much into this as well as an herbalist. What is it? Marigolds that are is something you referred to or that she referred to that are supposedly. They help to keep the insect population away from the plants or something like that?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I don't know the details on that specifically, if they're a pesticide, a natural pesticide. But it's all the wildflowers that are going to bring the bees in.
Yeah.
And it's true that not only if every single person would do some small thing, not some huge thing, I mean, not everyone can come to Africa and help me with Archangel. Maybe some people can help support from home, which would be amazing. Maybe some people will come on my safaris with me. But if everyone just did some small thing, the problem is we're taking more than we're giving back.
Uh-huh.
And if we started giving back, the beauty of it is that it's fun. This is why so many people are gardening. Gardening is fun. Going to your local tiger sanctuary and volunteering, it's healthy, it's fun. So it also brings new joy and new meaning to our lives.
Yes.
And even if it is helping our bees and creating more beautiful gardens for them, that's really fun.
You know,
we've got to put our focus back on nature and take it a little bit further away from some of our technology.
You know, that's what I've
for our kids.
Well, and you're reiterating everything that a lot of my guests have been saying, that very thing. Nature is our teacher. We could employ nature in our education, in our economic system, in our religious philosophical system, in our social and there's nothing written down. There are no books of wisdom in that contest. You have to observe. You have to experience.
Yeah, that's right. And my books are a little attempt at that. And I've got a Christmas special coming up. I'm going to do the webinar for people all over the world. And I pray for people's animals. They send me their pictures, and I do the Christmas sermon, and then we look at all the pictures. I'm just going to tell you, Richard, they're going to come in from Korea and China and Brazil and all over Europe. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And acknowledging that your own animal at home is your spiritual teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm calling this program the Kings and Queens of Christmas. Because I said there is no greater king or queen of the Christmas spirit than your own animals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are teaching everything that humans need to learn. They're cheerful, they're forgiving, they're comforting us all, at all times. They're trying to cheer us up and make us happy and healthy. And if we can connect to them, cats are our meditation teachers, our prayer specialists, our psychologists, our ministers. If we can connect to these animals and learn how to listen to them, then that's the real beginning. I mean, how can we evolve as a species if we can't even hear our spiritual teachers? And we're surrounded by our spiritual teachers. They're the animals on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to get through to people. And people are just preoccupied with a bunch of nonsense that doesn't matter.
Yeah. And that's very interesting. You know, in the first segment, you described, of course, my relationship with Angus, and his job is not to chase tennis balls, but to get me out and work out. And what's really interesting is on only extremely rare occasions, have I ever gone out and had my cell phone in my pocket.
Good.
99% of the time, the phone is plugged into the charger in the house or wherever it is, but it's not with me. I've even wanted to go out to the end of Stern's Wharf out here and, oh, I don't know, see if I can make it to the buoy. But I don't want to contaminate the ocean any more than it is with a cell phone. There are times when I just wish to literally disconnect, just to cut myself off and as the phrase goes, get off the grid for a while. And you know what? It isn't a question of for us as humans, and I think you would echo this, getting off the grid for a while, and it would be beneficial. Sometimes you just need to do that. You need to take the time. It would be beneficial for you. It rejuvenates you. And I think that my wife and I are extremely fortunate and blessed to be living where we're living.
Because yeah, you are.
Not everybody can.
It sounds amazing. And we think of the grid, and I'm going to say that's the human grid.
Yes, the human grid.
Take yourself off the human grid mm-hmm. and connect to nature's grid,
yeah.
to God's grid, because that's where you're going to have a moment alone with a bear. If you'd been shouting into a cell phone, maybe that encounter wouldn't have gone so well.
Let me ask you a quick...
The bear needed your full attention.
Exactly. Or I could have given him the phone. He could make a call and say, would you get this guy out of here, please? I'm trying to have dinner.
That's right. He's interfering with me. He's watching me eat. It makes me nervous.
Makes me nervous. Exactly. I've got... My stomach is now all upset, and now I'm going to have to see my physician, and on and on. The list goes on. Let me ask you a couple of questions in regards to your upbringing, because one thing that shot through my mind as you were talking about this, reconnecting with nature, nature's grid, as it were, I got to thinking about the aspect of what it was like as a child in the backyard of my parents' home, because it was my parents' home, and I just happened to be born and raised there, playing in the dirt. And digging holes and, you know, whatever things I was playing with in the dirt, but I was playing in the dirt. My hands were in the earth. And I'm curious as to that kind of an experience. Did you have that, or were you more involved with the creatures that roamed on top of the earth as far as the animal kingdom, which is, so to speak, the forebearer of what you have become today?
Well, I grew up in a trailer park outside of Denton, Texas. So it's probably the reason that I ended up doing what I do for a living, because there wasn't anything else to do except go out and run around barefoot and play with the grasshoppers and be with the animals. And if you could imagine, I mean, you just gave me this vision. I've got this vision of my two nieces who I adore, but when I walk in the house, they're both on their phones. Now, they're 12 and 10,
mm-hmm.
obsessed with their games.
Yeah.
So when Animalia comes in, we draw, we dance, we write books, we create things. We don't have any entertainment coming at us. We create the entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But how can children care about nature and save the earth if they don't even touch it? And you're talking about, not only would I make mud pies all day, I'd eat them. I was so in touch with the earth. And I think children have to be encouraged to go out and fall in love with things, even if it's observing insects and watching the baby birds hatch and caring about the squirrel or the raccoon who has new children this spring. And you know what I mean?
Yeah. Being,
why would they want to save it if they don't even love it?
And by the way,
I love it.
And by the way, that mud pie, probably more nutritious than anything we have today.
Maybe so. Now I'm going to bring it back to your opening statement, which was so funny. Now, when dogs eat cat poop, what they're looking for is mineral.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I would do is put those dogs on a vitamin mineral supplement, make sure that they're able to get those minerals, because that's what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But in the second hand, cat poop, because there's still a lot of good nutrition in it. I also would vary their diet so they have different flavors, different things to chew on,
so
that they're not bored with their food, going looking for something more interesting. Most people just have little kitty, like a little igloo over the litter box. I always have.
The igloo would be so large because our cats are large cats. I mean, we're talking about 15 to 20 pounds. I mean, we are, and they're not all Maine Coons. Some of them we have, we actually have a gray and white. I still call it Tuxedo Kitty because it's the gray and white or the tan and white or the calico and white. They're just different suits, different colored tuxedos. But they're ranging from 15 to 20 pounds, and they're good sized cats to where my wife, we used to foster with an organization called ASAP here in Santa Barbara, foster cats, kittens, mamas who were about to give birth, queens, as they say. And we were supposed to return a set of fosters to the facility. And, of course, I'm coming home from work, and I come in the door, close the door, and I turn around, and out from under the dining room table walks this tiny little tan and white kitten. And I ended up naming it Ryan. He became my special kitty because I wasn't expecting him. My wife was supposed to return them all, and she didn't return them all, and she brought this one back for me. He likes to lay on my arm, which I have to have him stop doing because I'm starting to get some injuries from the weight. And he seems to be okay as long as he's nuzzled up against me. But the igloo would be a rather large igloo, about the size for a human just about. But I know what you mean. I know what you mean in that context. The bear.
You created something that worked.
Yeah. And
you came up with a very creative solution to the problem.
And it took away my angst and my frustration over the situation of them going and doing that. And again, I do understand the reason why they're doing it. And that's why I go back to what I said before at the front end of the program. You need to understand why. And if you don't, then find someone who can help you to understand, like Amelia, like Amelia Kincaid at AmeliaKincaid.com. Certainly, there are reasons why cats do what they do. We have one, his name is Sid, named after the Buddha, Siddhartha. He's nothing like a Buddha, I must tell you. He will sit up on the counter where Merlin used to sit when we come home. And when he opens his mouth to get our attention, it's the smallest sound I think a cat can possibly make that can be heard. It's one of those. But having animals in one's life, you don't have to have six cats and two dogs and 14 chickens and the list goes on. You can just have, we actually started out with the pack of four Siberian Huskies in the backyard, and that's where they stayed because, they'd tear up the house. We used to have a parakeet, a lovebird, I should say, a lovebird by the name of Merlin, who then, of course, became the namesake of Merlin the cat. And you can start out with a bird. We had fish. By the way, I'm sure you're familiar with some of the healing modalities like Reiki.
Sure.
We had an angelfish whose name escapes me, but he was a white and black angelfish who, for some reason, became ill. And we noticed he started to list to one side and float near the top. And, oh, my gosh, he's going to die. And I was really surprised at how much attention we gave this angelfish. It's a fish. You go to the store, you buy a new one, right? We didn't do that. My wife puts her hand in the water, cupping, not touching necessarily, but cupping underneath, using Reiki. We're both Reiki masters. And for the next, I think for the next couple of days, we did this pretty regularly. And eventually the list went away. He turned right. He turned upright, if you will, proper fishing, swimming position, and probably lived another month or two. I mean, you know, and there's a part of me that goes, who does that? You know, I mean, you hear about the story of the kid whose goldfish died. Well, what do you do with the goldfish? You flush it down the toilet. This is one of the experience. This is one of many experiences I've had with animals since I met this woman almost 20 years ago. That has just, you know, and I didn't plan it this way, not consciously anyway. And so I've kind of opened myself up to this, and that's what I'm encouraging. And I know you're doing the same thing. You're encouraging people to do that. Open yourself up. You don't have to go out. You don't have to go to Africa with Amelia, although she's inviting you.
Although some of you may.
Some of you may.
Some of your listeners may.
Yeah.
And I need to tell you that I'm teaching a seminar in Palm Springs, which is not very far from your flock, in Santa Barbara. They don't bring their own animals from home, but they bring photos of their own animals. And I'll have live animals there in the seminar. People fly in from all over the country for these things. It's always such fun. We get the most amazing animal lovers. And maybe someday I'll get an invitation to Santa Barbara, because that's not very far from me. I could hop in the car and just drive on up there.
Well, I am going to, as I do with many of my guests on the phone or on Skype, invite you. Should you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you on the program to continue this conversation in person. The energy is so much different. I never turn down an interview if I can help it. But I love having people in studio and conversing face to face and talking more about this, because I honestly think, of all of the subjects that one could talk about that are deemed serious and important, honestly, as frivolous as this might seem to some, I honestly think this is probably one of the most, if not the most important, conversations one needs to have with oneself, is why am I not feeling better than I am? And why don't I have animals in my life, or an animal? Like, yeah. I said, it doesn't have to be huge. It can be a goldfish.
The animals that I've written about in Whispers from the Wild are reflecting the future of the human race. I mean, nothing could be more important than taking a look at our ecosystem and our world and trying to rectify the damage that we humans have done. So nothing could be more important. And with most people, your love for your dog, your cat, your horse is the most pure love that you know how to give, because it's unconditional. They love us unconditionally. And all love is good love. All love is pure love. So we have a connection to our planet and a connection to our own spirituality. And what in this life could be more important than that?
Yeah. And it can bring you so much joy. I also have to say, too, and you do have to be realistic in that you do understand, folks, that by bringing an animal into your life, you're going to experience the full realm of having an animal in your life. And what I mean by that is that I have had to deal with the loss of 10 animals in the last 20 years, less than 20 years. And that is, it never gets easy. I'm thankful that it doesn't. I would hate to become jaded and complacent over the loss of one of our animals. I have to say that when Merlin, who is the last one to pass, the latest one to pass in April of 2016, I was actually headed out the door on a trip. And I don't know where this came from, but I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. And my wife and I agreed, and you can attest to this, we're going to place him in the lid of a cardboard box, a file box, and we're going to put a towel or what have you, or his favorite blanket, and we're going to lay him on the dining room table on this blanket in this lid, and basically he's going to lie in state so that the other cats can pay their respects. And then we'll take care of what we need to the next day when I get back. And that's what we did.
I love that you did that. That they get to pay homage to him.
Yeah. I mean, he was born in our home back in Phoenix. We took in a stray female. Her name was Little Bit. And she was a small female, and she became impregnated, and we kept her in our garage, and she gave birth to 4 kittens. We gave away the other 3. We kept him. And so we've had him. We're the only people he's known as far as owner, masters, if you will, or partners or what have you. And we brought him with us to Santa Barbara. And and I've had to bury, the last of the 4 Siberian Huskies up on the hill where we live. And, of course, Merlin. And, of course, his pal that we took ownership of after our dear friend passed in our home, a black cat named Amos, who had a partner back in Phoenix, a female named Andy, also a black cat. But this is part of the process of this. And I remember in my first marriage with my first wife, who was totally blind, and she went to get a guide dog. And I told myself I would not get close to this dog because that part of it I didn't want to deal with. Well, it doesn't work because if you're living in the same house, you're going to get close. You're going to get close.
But I hate it when people say, I can't have an animal because I can't stand it when they die, because we have to just keep on loving.
Yeah, that's it.
The love has to go on and on. Then you go out, you rescue 2 more. And you continue to love them, and you let the circle of life be part of your life and not be afraid of them.
Yeah. I want to ask you, and I mean, you have hundreds, if not thousands, of stories of the various animals that you have come across. But has there been one in particular that impressed or impacted you more so than any other that you can share with us? And I don't necessarily mean the sad stories, but I mean, it could be an extraordinary event or what have you. Like I said, you've got thousands of stories, and I'm sure it's probably very difficult to pick one, but can you give us, just one that changed your life?
Well, I opened this, and I've got to close with this. I'm sorry to say, Richard, I've got another interview in 5 minutes.
Sure.
I opened this book with a story of a tiger in a sanctuary in Florida, and the NBC Nightly News had a camera in my face. I'd never been to the sanctuary. I'd never done any sort of web search on the place. I don't cheat at all. And when I tuned into the cast, I said, tell me something. The news is coming out tomorrow. I'm under all this pressure. What's new out there? Has anything big changed? And they all said, there's something wrong with our eldest tiger. I said, what is it? He said, he's having problems with one of his teeth. And I said, which tooth is it? And they said, it's an upper left molar. Well, in my mind, I went from the jaguar to the next tiger to the next tiger, and I heard the same story over and over and over. And I turned to the camera the next day, and I said, they all say their eldest tiger is having problems with one of his teeth. It's an upper left molar. When I happened upon that tiger, he was still dripping blood from his mouth. And he had an inoperable cancer tumor in his brain. They had taken out one of his upper left molars to try to operate to remove the cancer. Well, that tiger was the one where I made the commitment, and I said, listen, I promise I'll do everything in my power to help you, to prove to humans that you animals can communicate with us, that we are intelligent enough to evolve to learn how to hear you and listen. And I will live my entire life trying to do service to your people, your species, do what I can do to help the animals of this planet.
That's beautiful.
And
that's...
on that note, I'm sorry, I think I have to say goodbye.
Well, I thank you again for joining us. Again, Amelia Kincaid is the website, ameliakincaid.com. Thank you so much, and I hope that we get a chance to talk to you again very soon.
I love it, and I hope that I get to come up and do another show with you in person.
I'd love it. I'd love it. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.